You're nicked, Arthur. And you, Sunshine.
You can't arrest me. I'm an architect. There's my Porsche.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. In this show, we have part two of an interview with Andrew Payne, writer of 12 Minder episodes, including some real classics, several of which we discuss here in detail, including Back in Good Old England, Goodbye Sailor, Dream House, and Minder on the Orient Express. Andrew talks about appearing on the set of Minder and what happened when his very first episode was being filmed. He also mentions the dissatisfaction he felt at the time and what happened there. He mentions George Cole's filming habits, as well as the feature-length Minder film which was ultimately made for TV. What if Arthur and Terry had gone to Venice? Andrew talks about his most memorable episode and the reasons why. The clue is Richard Griffiths, who would also feature in Andrew's acclaimed comedy drama, Pie in the Sky. The clips you'll hear come from some of the shows Andrew mentions, but I also wanted to include a few from the last video show episode, which we did not get time to talk about. I feel this is quite an overlooked episode, and it also turned out to be Andrew's last credit for Minder. It was a credible concept and also featured the two storylines running throughout the episode, which Andrew does talk about as a favourite method of creating Minder scripts. This was also an episode with a tremendous cast, and we'll talk more about it in a future show. For now, it is back to Andrew Payne for part two of Minder on the Hornsey Express, or A Nice Little Earner, on this episode 12 of the Minder podcast, in association with Minder.org. In the initial episode, so when you first started, did you meet the cast members to get a feel, or were you ever on set or anything like that?
Occasionally, very rarely. Well, I tell you, okay, I mean, once in a blue moon. I mean, you know, on occasion, on the set, they're incredibly busy. You know, and once you've been working on something for a certain amount of time, the script is ready. You know, you're there really. Do you know what I mean? There's not much you can add. I mean, socially, it's nice to turn up now and then and say hello, and then there'd be the wrap party and that sort of thing. But really, it's incredibly boring because you've got nothing to do. I mean, you're the kind of writer. You know, you're regarded with a sort of degree of suspicion, particularly by the crew, you know, and you trip over things and get in the way, and everybody's very busy, and everything takes forever, you know, and you watch, you know, somebody walk across the road, get into a car five times, and you're ready to go home, you know. The very first one, I used to live, when I wrote the first one, Dessert Song, the restaurant one, I was living in Hornsey Lane, and to the top of Crouch End. And I used to walk every morning down to Crouch End to get coffee and, you know, sandwich or whatever at lunchtime. And so I get the call from Linda, we're going to make your episode. Great. They started shooting it quite soon. I thought there was no read-through. We never had a read-through online. I had no idea about where or they were shooting, what the schedule was. Well, I was just delighted that they were doing it, you know. So I walked down one morning to Crouch End to, you know, my usual routine. And I walked down the hill to Crouch End, pub on the right called the Railway, which I used to go to when I was, this is where I was, I'm still living where I was an art student. Do you know what I mean? So there's a weird kind of worlds colliding. But it got even weirder that morning because opposite the Railway was a Greek restaurant. And I'm walking down and there's all this stuff going on outside the restaurant, you know. There's kind of like, you know, caravans and trailers and people running around. And I thought, what the fuck's that? What's going on? You know, and I walk down and I see George Cole sitting in a chair by the, you know, smoking a cigar and looking at the Racing Post, you know, which is what his thing was, you know. And I thought, oh my God, this must be, of course, it's a great restaurant. It's my episode, you know. And I was just incredibly embarrassed. So I crossed the road, went down and got my coffee sandwich and went back home and let, you know, I sort of thought it's nothing to do with me in a weird kind of way. And I thought if I go along and say, hi, you know, this is my, I wrote this, you know, I'm sure, you know, the people say, yeah, so, and excuse me, do you mind, you know, we need that. You're in the, I don't know. It was weird. It was kind of quite a weird experience.
Sounds remarkably professional for a young person with the first big TV script to be that humble or shy or.
I was. It's very strange. I mean, I look back on it with kind of degree of embarrassment. Really, I mean, it's so stupid, you know. But that's how, I guess, the point of that story is. I mean, because when I was trying to write the first one, I really got very down about my inability to write a script that worked, you know. And I suppose when eventually I did write a script that worked, and not only did I manage to do that, they then wanted to film it. I suppose it was all such a kind of unlikely. By the time I'd been through the mill on that one, it was so unexpected and so quick. Maybe I just didn't kind of quite trust it. You know, I thought it was a sort of, you know, a weird hallucination or something. But, you know, and if I kind of went and involved myself and went over to them and said hello and introduced myself, it would somehow break the spell, you know. Just let them get on with it, you know.
How about when you saw it on TV for the first time?
That, again, was a huge learning curve. I was invited by the producers to go and look at a cut of it down at the production base, which I can't remember where that was. It's somewhere quite weird. It was down near Hammersmith, I think, at the time. And I was rather critical of it, I'm afraid. So, you know, from the kind of the humble, embarrassed bloke who walked around the location without introducing, I then became a sort of, you know, super critical writer who doesn't approve of what's been done with the script. And it was quite, Roy Ward Baker did it, who was an old hand, you know, it was quite pedestrian, I thought, you know, and there was one or two things when I thought, you know, I mean, and again, I didn't really understand the problems with schedules and stuff like that. But there were certain things when I just thought there should be a close up there of that. And that's, you know, and why is this just this whole scene being played out in a wide shot? And what's important in this bit of in this scene is what Terry is doing with, you know, or the guy with a knife who's going to stab Terry, whatever. And I just thought it was very direct in a very pedestrian way. So, which I'm afraid I said, you know. And I think they were slightly taken aback, you know, because I think I was supposed to probably say, oh, my God, it's marvelous. I'm so excited. My first, you know, blah, blah, blah. And there I was saying, you know, why did he cut away then when he, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the lesson there is that, I mean, is this boring? I mean, is this it?
No, whatsoever.
Look at those lions.
Yes, one is a little bit foxed around the arse here.
It's not the only one, is it, either?
There is. Oh, no, I think they're terribly witty.
Witty? No, Arthur said that. He said, my word, what witty little lions, he said, didn't you, mate?
Shut up. Yes, I'll have them. I'm very fond of putting things like that indoors.
On your mantelpiece?
Something like that, yes. Well, Martin? Right, Arthur, I'll have the gates, the fireplace, and the lions. I'm afraid that those urns are not for me at all, though.
Those urns are sensational.
Sensational?
Nope. Nope, I don't know, they're somehow deeply naff.
Naff?
Naff?
You heard what a man said, those are naff urns. Now help Mr. Miller's man load his stuff onto his van. Nigel, word inside.
Certainly, Arthur.
Inside. I'll see you later down at Winchester, all right?
I do acquiesce with you about the urns, Nigel. But you're quite happy about the rest of the gear?
Fabulous stuff, Arthur.
Oh, fabulous. And such a bargain. Look, if anything else comes up that you want, just give me a bell. You never know what's going to turn up.
Someone might leave the whole house on a skip.
Sorry, Tony, not with you.
Terry. The name is Terry.
Terry, don't interrupt when money is changing hands.
Why don't you come down to the site this afternoon, Arthur? Have a look round. Something I'd like to discuss with you. That is, if Terry here doesn't object.
No, I'd be delighted, Nigel. Any news about my premises?
Nothing definite. I've had a word with the managing agents. But the thing is, these people are killing to get into these retail units.
Well, they would. I can't wait to get my foot in the door of a free enterprise zone.
Hang in there, Arthur. I'm working on it. I'll see you this afternoon.
Right, Nigel. Oh, hang about. Complimentary T-shirt. My compliments.
Fabulous.
See you, Nigel.
Fabulous.
What I learned was that, I see the movie, the TV show, whatever, is in my head when I write it. I see the shots and I see the locations and I imagine wherever it is. I have a very clear picture of it in my head. And, of course, you only put down the merest indications in the script. You can't go into too much detail, A, because it's boring to read, B, because it's going to be different anyway, you know. But you have to indicate. But you see it very clearly. So it's always a shock when you see the finished article. Because, obviously, it's going to be different. It's going to look different, you know. And the thing you have to learn to do is to separate when you're looking at rough cuts and stuff, separate what is just your surprise at the difference in what you're seeing from what you saw in your head and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you see something and it's a shock because, my God, look at that location. But that's not the same as something that doesn't work because it's been cut together wrong or because it's, you know, they've missed something important. Do you know what I mean? And early on, I made that mistake. I mean, I was quite hard on directors and producers, sometimes unfairly so, because what I was balking at was you didn't make the film I saw in my head, you know. And then sometimes 2 years later I'd see something, a repeat or something, and I'd watch it and I think, you know, by then I've forgotten the film I saw in my head, you know, that's gone. What remains is what they filmed, and I think, actually, that's really quite good. You know, what they did was really good. And I wish I hadn't been so down on that, you know. But, of course, sometimes, you know, you have legitimate beefs, you know. They've cut things together. I mean, directing is, you know, the writer tells a story and then the director has to tell a story. You know, the director is telling a story as well and has to understand the story and understand, you know, what is best and most entertaining and informative for the audience to be looking at any given moment, you know. And in this scene, what's going on in this scene? This scene is an argument between two people and they're both after a certain thing or they're both trying to lie about something. And once you've got that, and in a good script anyway, there should always be a point to the scene. Once you've got that, then you have to tell that story, you know, decide the best way to tell it. And sometimes you see something you think either the director didn't get the story, didn't care, or, you know, sometimes there's just unusable takes. It's the end of the day. The crew are acting up. Everyone's in a hurry. You know, it's difficult. But I got better at that. And it got to the point where I did a series called Pie in the Sky in the 90s, which we had for 4 series. And I was the executive producer on the last 2 of those. And so, you know, I used to go to the rough cuts. I used to go to the dubs. I used to love all that. I mean, I got to the point where I used to love all that.
Didn't you actually, you created that yourself as well?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I really enjoyed that because it's about storytelling. It's all about storytelling. And so you look at a rough cut and you think, maybe this sequence works better if we see that first or if we don't see that at all. Or I used to love the dub, fantastic. You know, you're in this fantastic air-conditioned, dark and sweet, you know, pick up the phone and wine is brought and fish and chips, whatever you want. And you can spend like an hour fiddling around with the noise a fridge makes when it closes, you know, kind of wrapping it up a bit. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just really, it's really good fun. And of course, you know, much more enjoyable than writing, you know, or you feel like you're working, but you're not having to write, you know, which is always good. But that was, yeah, so, but I mean, Minder was very kind of, there wasn't a huge amount of involvement. I mean, George, I used to see them, you know, at rap parties and stuff. George was always very amiable, really charming man. Dennis, you know, fine. Everybody was, you know, it was a very kind of pleasant experience. And, of course, great to be involved in writing something that became such a hit, you know.
Do you think your scripts got better and because there's some really classic episodes that you wrote. So, for instance, I think a lot of people would say Goodbye Sailor, Dreamhouse. Yeah. What did you think of those couple episodes for it?
Well, I think I did get better, yes, because I was learning my craft as the show went on, you know, because I was, you know, because I was a beginning, you know, it was my first job. So, I mean, I got better at putting together a story. And I think one of the things I enjoyed was when I kind of twigged, you know, was having a subplot, you know, like Arthur would, my memory is hazy somewhere, but Arthur would have something like in Goodbye Sailor, it was tobacco smuggling. But there would be another problem he had, which was like something maybe rather trivial. Terry would have a problem. So you could cut between the two stories, which is a great thing to do because you're on this story, you're on the A story, and this happens and there's a problem. But then you can cut to the B story. And by the time you get back to the A story, it's all moved on. So the audience are kind of, you know, there's a sense of, and what's great is when the two can somehow unexpectedly come together. And I'm trying to think of an example where I managed that. But stuff like that, I got better at. I don't know, you know, I remember with great affection an episode called Back in Good Old England. Mm-hmm. And I remember it because Pete Postlethwaite was in it, who was fantastic actor. It was so great to have him, and he was just great. And I just liked that story because it was really about a fantasist, you know, who comes back to England because he's had to do a runner to Spain.
Terry, Arthur, Des.
Who the bloody hell's that?
Oh, me, Jack O'Rag. Hello, my son. How are you? Terry.
Oily Ray. Yeah.
Never eat. Oh, do, Jack. Nice to see you.
My old man. Yes, pot of shampoo for my very good friends here, please, Dave.
Lovely.
Por favor, listen.
Yeah,
what?
I think you better wheel it on now, Dave.
Right, yeah.
Back in good old England. Salute, fellas.
Salute. Listen, I thought you'd get nicked as soon as you trod on the tarmac at Gatwick.
Oh, I never left because of the law, too. Oh, I just wanted to turn over a new leaf, that's all. Best thing I ever did.
Well, here we are.
What about that, then?
Welcome home, Jack.
Hey.
Hey! Well, gracias, fellas, for turning up here today.
Didn't have much choice, did we?
That means a great deal to me. Well, I just got a couple of business calls to make, but in the meantime, help yourselves. We can keep this coming till morning, can't we, Dave?
Certainly can.
God dear, Jack O'Rag.
Business calls. Probably dialing a speaking clock.
I didn't think I'd see him back in England.
Well, you wouldn't have missed much, would you?
He's all right, is Jacko.
He's a bloody menace.
That's his shampoo you're drinking.
I didn't want to hurt his feelings, did I? But if he starts all that, I said to Biggsy, and Biggsy said to me, cobblers, I'll have a nervous breakdown.
Listen, when I was in the scrubs, Jacko told me to keep my head down and do the bird. If I hadn't shared a Peter with him, I would have been in all sorts of bother.
Oh, heart of gold, say no more.
And he gets back into the country and is pretending to large it, and he's got all this money and he wants to, you know, buy me a car, do this, I want to invest. And it's all absolute bollocks, you know. But it's really just because he's homesick, you know, and wants to see everybody again and wants a bit of respect. And of course, everything's changed. And I just like that. I liked that. That's a nice story to write, and it worked quite well, I think.
Seeing as you mentioned that, I'm just wondering, with what you said there, why you ended that episode with him actually going back and kind of the implication being he'll never come back again to England.
I think so, yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I think that sort of nostalgia is often misplaced. And maybe if I wrote that story now, I would probably come on a bit stronger about that, you know, about he's not only is going back to Spain, is, you know, again, has to, you know, he's getting away from the law. It's also because it, you know, his memory, it wasn't what he remembered, you know, it had changed. He's no longer, wasn't his home anymore, which I think is kind of, there's a kind of truth in that. Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Well, you also wrote in that episode that his wife had divorced him and moved on.
Yeah. I'd forgotten that. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's exactly. I mean, what, and in a way, you know, I mean, back in the day, I did meet a couple of people who had decamped to Spain, you know, and it's kind of, oh, it's great, it's sun, and, you know, I mean, there was that very fantastic film, Sexy Beast.
I was just thinking of that when you said that.
Yeah, yeah. Which was about that very thing. And it was always kind of tragic in a way. It was always very sad, you know. And there was a kind of, they hadn't really kind of, they'd moved geographically, but mentally, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, they hadn't. They were still, you know, stuck in. Back in good old England, you know, which of course was not what it was when they left. So you're kind of caught between the two. It's an interesting sort of, you know, anyway. But one of my, I mean, God knows what I think if I saw it now, but I was also very fond of an episode called Dream House, which had Richard Griffiths in it. And I quite like the sort of, I mean, madness of that, really. And I mean, I said to Linda something like, oh, I want to do a story about what's it like to be the not very attractive, not very talented brother of a famous pop star. I mean, how do you cope with that? And I said, what about if actually the pop star's broke and he's got his big house, Terry's got a babysitter, and the brother turns up, the mad brother turns up to wreak revenge, you know? So that's how that, and she said, oh, yeah, do that. You know, that's the only conversation we had about that. And of course, they cast Richard Griffiths in it. It's the first time I met Richard, and again, it's a bit like getting Pete Postlethwaite. I thought, oh, fantastic, you know, Richard Griffiths. So I'm very fond of that because then Richard and I went on to work on Pie in the Sky. And so that was our first, my first encounter with the great man.
I'm Derek Farrow. Frankie's brother, manager, accountant, wet nurse, highly paid toady. And in all of those capacities, I demand to know what you were doing creeping around this house.
Well, I'm Terry. Terry McCann.
I shall contact the old Bill.
No, the phone's not working.
Put the mockers on the phone, eh? Very clever.
No. Look, would I be lumbering around like this if I was turning the place over, eh?
Me? I'm an Oxford and Harvard Business School man. I move foreign currencies around like some people move mushy peas. And if I ever find out you're giving me the runaround, sunshine, I shall come down on you like a ton of breeze blocks.
George Silver's the geezer who hired me.
Georgie Silver? An errand boy, 10% parasite. How he's got a bottle of iron fire around this house, I do not know. Nonetheless, I am prepared to accept that you are not some itinerant blagger.
Oh. Oh, there's something wrong here. There's something... There's another sofa in here last time I looked in this room.
Yeah, well, it's on the lawn.
On the lawn?
Well, I fancied sleeping under the stars. Anyway, the arrangements of the furniture is none of your concern.
Listen, I'm supposed to be safeguarding this little lot.
Well, it's just a brotherly in-joke, you know. It's, it won't damage, I promise.
Wait, hold on. All right, who are you and what are you doing here? Listen, don't think those glass ashtrays you're wearing are going to stop me giving you a slap, so you better start talking.
Beam me up, Scotty.
So I have affection for that. I mean, it's very odd looking back on it, to be honest. And I know they kind of, they crop up on ITV4 now and then. I actually kind of avoid watching them because I'm fond of the series. I'm very grateful to it. I was very pleased to be part of it. But it's kind of gone, do you know what I mean? And I don't want to really look at them and be disappointed or see. I mean, I do tend to just see the flaws, you know, in my stuff when I watch it again. It's quite hard to, you know. I mean, when I say the flaws, I mean my flaws. I don't mean anybody else's. I'm talking about.
I'm shaking my head because I'm wondering how you can see flaws in what appears to be perfect. And I mean, I can see why. Obviously, like you said, your script didn't really change, so everybody agreed that it was pretty perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just, yeah, stupid. I don't know. Maybe flaws is the wrong word, but I just, you know. I mean, I suppose it's a bit like looking at a younger version of yourself, you know, and thinking, I'm not, that somebody else wrote that. You know, because so much time has passed and so much has happened, and it's this kind of double-edged thing, you know. Goodness, what it must be like to be an actor. I can't imagine, you know, if you're an actor who's done a lot of stuff and, you know, and there's your younger self, you know, constantly being recycled in movies and TV and stuff. It must be an odd, maybe just get used to it, I don't know. I would find it very odd, I think.
Have you found yourself treated as if you're associated with Minder by, you know, with new work and things?
Not really, no. Because most people that work in TV now are kind of so young, you know. I mean, they weren't born when Minder was. I mean, the show that I'm mostly associated with now is, it was Pie in the Sky during the 90s. And now it's Midsummer Murders, you know, because I've done quite a few of those. And of course that's still going in some form or other, and but without John Nettles. Again, I wrote John Nettles' last Midsummer Murder. I seem to be like Dennis Waterman. I seem to be, I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, to be the kind of to be the last writer on the, you know. But that tends to be what people think of now, you know.
I don't know. You invest in youth, and what do they do?
And yesterday, Arthur.
Spit in your face. Good morning. I'm disappointed in you, Tracy. A wine bar. Where is it? Transylvania?
Ha, oh, bloody ha.
I'd like to return these.
Well, don't give them to me. I don't work here anymore, thank God.
There's gratitude for you.
See you, Terry.
Yeah, good luck, love.
And don't let the old fart grind you down.
Would somebody please take these tapes?
Yes, give them to my assistant, will you? He's temporarily in charge.
No, I'm sorry. No, it's nothing to do with me.
Oh, by the way, I'm Arthur Daly. It's not often I get the chance to meet our members.
Listen, you, I'm not
Look,
working here.
Look, I am in a hurry, actually.
Oh, don't leave empty-handed. We have the new Jack Nicholson.
Can I just ask you about the Minder on the Orient Express? If you
don't know. Right.
Just because, obviously, it was a longer, effectively, like, 2 episodes long.
Yeah.
And, based around, I mean, was the idea from Murder on the Orient Express first, or how did it come together? And how did you write such a script?
Well, that came together because that was another weird story, really, because initially they wanted to make a movie. It was going to be a movie for theatrical release. And I had lunch with Linda Agron, as we used to do quite a lot. And she said, I had an idea. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said, Minder on the Orient Express, which, of course, immediately made me laugh, you know. I mean, that was it. That was, you know, it wasn't a story, actually, but just Minder on the Orient Express. And she said, how about that for Minder the movie, you know, which they want to do. So that's the start of that. So then I had to, so we're talking about kind of 90 minutes, you know, 100 minutes or whatever. I can't remember how it was in the, as a movie. So then I thought, this is great, because I would love to pay homage to those kind of, you know, like the original Minder on the Orient Express. I just love, I mean, the opening scene when you get kind of, you know, all these kind of movie stars, you get Michael York and Ingrid Bergman and God knows who walking down the platform, and, you know, Wendy Hiller as the mad Russian, I don't know, American, you know. And I thought to do a version of that, a Minder version, that would be very amusing and very good fun. But of course, you've got to have a plot, you know, you've got to get these people on a train for a reason. And then being really, really difficult, you know, really hard work. I got halfway through the script and was summoned to Euston Films, and something had been going on. And this was after Verity Lambeth had left. And I think there was a bit of politicking going on at Euston Films. I don't know. Anyway, to cut a long story short, there was some people there were appalled at the notion, the potential expense of Arthur and of George Cole and Dennis Waterman Minder arriving in Venice, because obviously the climax was going to be Venice, because that's where the Orient Express goes now, you know. So I came out of the meeting and had been told in no uncertain terms that there's no way could we go to Venice. Okay, so I had to completely rewrite the, you know, the story. And Arthur pulls the emergency cord and they get off the train in the Alps in Shepherd's Bush somewhere, you know. God, I mean, it was really... And, of course, the trouble is that to pay homage to those kind of big old Hollywood movies, you ain't got the money or the time to really do it properly, is the bottom line. So, again, I haven't looked at that for years. I've got no idea what it's like. But it was kind of, that was hard work. I remember one joke from that, which I quite like, and it's the only thing in the film that I remember, really, is I tried to do a kind of, again, another a homage to A Night at the Opera, the Marx Brothers film, where they all, where they're in the cabin, they're all sharing this tiny cabin. I don't know if you remember that. And people keep piling in. Have you not seen that?
No.
All right, fantastic. Marx Brothers, check it out one day. There's this whole sequence where there's this tiny cabin on this liner, this ocean liner, and with the Marx Brothers in it, and they've got a castaway in there, and waiters and chefs and people, butlers keep coming in with stuff until this tiny cabin is cramped. So I did a version of that. Everybody cramming into Arthur Daly's compartment on the Orient Express. And there was, I think, Honor Blackman was in it,
yeah.
I think. And she's in the compartment with all these other people. And somebody else turns up with drinks or something. It's getting completely incredibly crowded. And Arthur says something like, "Oh, Gordon Bennett." And Honor Blackman says, "Oh, Gordon, is he on the train as well? How lovely." And that. I don't know why. I'm very fond of that joke.
Did you put her into the... Did you ever suggest who you wanted as the actor or actress in your screen?
No, never. 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 I was never involved in anything like that. No.
But with her, she obviously took that role the way...
Sorry?
She took that role the way it was intended, based on what you just said.
Oh, yeah, she was great. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that my memory of that, it was a weird period, and it was one of those, unlike the and of course what happened in the end was, it was never released as a movie, because I think, again, I've maybe got this wrong, they realised that the sale, if as a TV show, the sale to Australia alone would pay for the budget for the thing, you know. So actually, just forgetting about the theatrical release, you know, the marketing and getting the prints made for the cinema, all that kind of stuff, you know. Forget it, you know, just boom, straight to TV, which is probably financially sensible. Yeah. So it was never a movie. And I think that's probably right, actually. I don't think it was a movie, really. You can't, you know. I mean, the giveaway is we never went to Venice. So, you know, limited resources. And it probably would have looked, not because people weren't doing their best, but just purely down to money, really, probably would have looked a bit thin on the cinema screen, you know. So yeah, it became TV. It went out on TV.
Well, thank you for all your time, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry, you know, it's difficult talking about something that happened so long ago, really. It's weird, you know. I had to go just before we started. I had to go on the IMDb and see how many I wrote and see what they were called, you know. Because and really, my memory was not very clear, you know. But so no, it's interesting to talk about it.
You should have seen him when he came out. He said, "Have there been any great technological advances while I've been away?"
How long were you inside for, Arthur?
You can lock a man up, but you cannot imprison his spirit. It's up here. If you got it up here, incarceration means nothing.
An hour and a half. He was banged up for an hour and a half.
I like. So you had a right result, thanks to Terry.
Yeah. True. Once Terry didn't make a pig's ear of it.
Oh, cheers, Arthur.
Oh, we got out of that a treat. No problem.
Yeah, no problem.
My sincere thanks once again to Andrew Payne and his agent Lydia Drake for taking the time to organise the interview, as well as all the time Andrew spent talking to me. Thanks also to Jonathan from Minder.org for additional questions. Next time we will have a very different type of episode, featuring some interesting and unusual facts about the show. As a teaser, here is a strange spot of trivia for you to accompany the Andrew Payne episodes. In researching as much as I could about him, I read an interview with Andrew where he mentioned a Turkish-Kurdish restaurant that he frequents called Jem. I must say he did tell me later though that it's not quite as good as it used to be. Anyway, before I knew this, I couldn't resist looking it up. And when looking at the street view, what should I find directly opposite the restaurant but Montague Solicitors? Remember Mr. Sain? That is the part played by Lee Montague, the potential Arthur Daly, who Andrew mentioned in the first interview. And here, opposite Andrew's then-favourite restaurant, is Montague Solicitors. What are the odds? Possibly only odds that the Wizard of Odds could have come up with. Thank you to everyone who's written in. If you want to write to the show, the email is winchesterclub@minderpodcast.co.uk. Thanks for listening.